The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Under the provisions of Title II of the 1950 Internal Security Act, also known as the McCarran Act, the President of the United States of America is still authorized, without further approval by Congress, to determine an event of insurrection within the United States and to declare the existence of an internal security emergency. The President is then authorized to apprehend and detain each person as to whom there is reasonable ground to believe probably will engage in certain future acts of sabotage. Persons apprehended shall be given a hearing without right of bail, without the necessity of evidence, and shall then be confined to places of detention.
The Marshal will now bring the 48th session of the tribunal to order.
48th Emergency Internal Security Tribunal of the Southwestern Region, as authorized by Executive Order Number 302, is now in session. William C. Holder, Chairman, presiding.
Punishment Park, described by the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Law and Order as a necessary training for the law officers and National Guard of the country in the control of those elements who seek the violent overthrow of the United States government and the means of providing a punitive deterrent for said subversive elements.
Anything between those two shots is blown away. It is no longer causing you any trouble. It does not exist anymore.
We've seen this! We've seen this!
That's fine.
Officer Edwards, we've seen this!
I don't give a flying.
We've seen this! This is going on NBC! We've seen this!
I don't care if you're taking jam in your ass!
You murdering bastard! You fucking bastard!
Welcome to a special edition episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me again this week is Rob St. Mary.
Thanks for having me back. Glad to be in front of the tribunal. By the way, I'm looking forward to that run for freedom through the desert.
Excellent. On this special episode, we're looking at Peter Watkins's 1971 film Punishment Park. Folks who are familiar with my writing know that I'm a huge fan of this movie, and it's come up in conversation and in the news a few times lately, so we thought we'd strike while the iron was hot. This film is a documentary made about a program where dissidents are given the option to go to jail or try their luck in Punishment Park, a harsh desert area where they have to hike for miles to an American flag while avoiding being captured or killed. Intercut with the last group who make their way through Punishment Park is another that stands trial in a kangaroo court before they have to head out and try their luck at surviving in the desert heat and harsh conditions while the police hunt for them. So, Rob, I know that you just saw this film for the first time recently, and what were your impressions when you saw this initially?
Yeah, I first learned about Peter Watkins, I think, when I was in film class 15-odd years ago. And I remember they showed us The War Game, which I thought was a fantastic film. It's only about an hour or so long. And what I really remembered the professor telling us at the time was, I believe the BBC had banned it because they had originally produced it. And for several years, they wouldn't show it to audiences because they thought it was just too disturbing at the time. The War Game was Watkins basically comparing sort of the government manual on what would happen during a nuclear attack versus the reality of such an event. And then it was shot very documentary style and used it to show the chaos and that what he thought the government was actually sort of lying to people about what would happen in the case of such an event. And I have to say, Punishment Park is pretty amazing. It's a very interesting film to watch, and I can understand why it got so little distribution, and people will probably be still disturbed by it, even though it's, you know, 40 years on since it came out.
Yeah, so I was only joking around, really, when I said it was a documentary. It's shot like a documentary, and a lot of people, I think, actually believe that it is a real film. I mean, it is a real film, but folks kind of don't realize that they are being messed with. And I think that's the best part of Watkins, is that he really knows how to make documentaries. He knows the language of documentaries and plays with that every single time that he goes out and makes a film. I mean, he's been making movies since, what, mid-60s.
I think what's interesting also about Punishment Park is we're so used to, I would say these days, pseudo-documentary being used for comedic ends. I mean, obviously Spinal Tap, things like that come to mind. But the idea of taking pseudo-documentary in a very dramatic fashion and then also to make sort of social points, I think, is something that's really kind of interesting and kind of new even. And as I said, the film's 40 years old, so it's kind of interesting to see someone take that tack with it.
Well, what's funny to me is that at this time, there were just, there were more than just this one going on. I mean, you had like Battle of Algiers, and you had Robert Kramer's Ice, and you had It Happened Here, and you had all these different films that were playing with documentary style and making a social point. Medium Cool, I guess, is another one of them. So Watkins was right there making this one along with all these other filmmakers, but he's the one that stuck with it and just kind of continued on that tack of making these pseudo documentaries and going forward with that. He also made an interesting one that really doesn't get enough airplay for me, which is called The Trap, and it's a Swedish film, not one of those kind of films, but it's a Swedish film. It's a made for TV film. And it's really neat. It's about this family that's living underground and along with the rest of society. And just, they're having this dinner that night. And it's this whole thing of how they're talking about, you know, the brother coming in and how he has to pass by all these checkpoints and what the political, you know, he uses this small dinner to kind of represent this whole larger picture of where the world is at. And it's kind of prescient in the way that he talks about the way that OPEC has really taken over kind of stuff and just how there's all these wars going on in the Middle East. Not that that would ever happen these days.
No, not at all.
Getting into some of the points in the film, what I like about the idea of using the documentary is how he's able to use some of the various nature of documentary itself in order to bring up the comments and to get the people to be very realistic, very naturalistic. It's my understanding that there may only be one or two quote-unquote actors within the film. Mm-hmm. Most of the people are just people that either pulled off the street or they were, you know, social protesters themselves. So a lot of my understanding of the dialogue and interaction kind of came out of just them sort of being themselves on camera and him, you know, grilling them as the voice behind the camera to get them to get to the points, I guess, that he wanted them to get to.
What I like that he does is that he has the whole the two-pronged narrative going on, where he's got, you know, the first group who's actually out in the park, and you intercut that with the group that's on the, in the tribunal. So you've got those two things going on. You know that the group who's going through their trial right now is soon going to be replacing that next group, and it's just that whole mechanism of, you know, because you know as soon as they go out, there's going to be another one that comes in after them. And I love the way that that stuff is intercut, and I think he really knew. I mean, the rhythm of the film is just so wonderful as far as when he knows to cut in individual scenes, as well as when to go back from what, from the tribunal to Punishment Park itself and vice versa.
And I think it also helps to build in sort of almost a factory-like process in this, where you have one group coming in, and as you're saying, you're intercutting with the previous group that's now running through the desert. And it also plays into the final line that you see on camera, which is one of the military men, police officers, and Watkins is grilling him, and the guy says to him, "It'll happen again as long as we have this type of element to deal with."
Right.
And there's just this idea that this can go on forever. We can continue to do this over and over and over again to each other. And talking about sort of what leads up to this is really the dichotomy that I think he sets up within the piece, where you have the left social dissidents who are coming in, who are being brought before the tribunal. And then you have sort of what people would consider maybe the Nixon silent majority types who are sitting in judgment of these people and trying to figure them out in some way. But nobody can figure each other out. They're basically screaming past each other, and they're getting each other into these arguments where it almost kind of sounds like cable TV at times. It sounds like a debate you might hear on CNN or Fox News, where you have the so quote-unquote left person and the quote-unquote right person, and they're hitting each other with hammers that are based on these like buzzword ideas, right. You know, sort of like trick questions of, so, you know, when did you stop beating your wife kind of stuff, you know, like, so you really hate America, don't you? Because obviously, if you're this rambunctious and you care so much about, you know, the plight of black folks in the inner city, and you care so much about this war effort, which is a just war, because they go into this whole question of what's a just war in the piece, then obviously you hate this country, you know. And you get into the places where some of the tribunal members are taking a break at one point, and they're like under this little canopy and they're getting something to eat, and they're talking amongst themselves, and they're talking about their own kids, and they're saying, yeah, my kids, you know, for a few years were a little rambunctious too. And they kind of equate the dissonance to livestock at one point. One guy says, he goes, you know, these are like trained animals. These are like thoroughbred horses, and you have to train them properly. Otherwise, you end up in a situation like what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting because you can still see that today. Mm-hmm. You can still see that there are certain elements in the far right who believe that, you know, a lot of the times when people talk about, you know, the social issues that are important to folks, whether they be inner city issues or, you know, the plight of maybe even things like the immigration issue that's come up in the last several years, or Occupy Wall Street and things like that, they don't see the validity of those arguments. They just see it as people who are spoiling the nature of America. I mean, this is the greatest country on earth, so, you know, why are you complaining?
Right. And love it or leave it.
Yeah, and there is that very sort of, on both ends, there's this extreme vision on both ends. And I think what Watkins is trying to get us to think about in the film is, how can you get these folks to talk to each other so that you don't end up in a situation like this?
Right.
Which is interesting talking about it, because in some of the reviews, people wanted to say this is like a science fiction film.
Right.
I read some reviews that said it was science fiction or futuristic. I mean, it takes place in 1971, and I don't see any science fiction elements. I see a dystopian element, possibly, but that doesn't necessarily make it science fiction.
Right. I suppose what they're getting to is the whole thing of giving these people, rather than putting them in jail or shooting them or doing whatever they want to do with them, giving them the chance to run through this park and be able to, if they reach the American flag, then they earn their freedom. You know, that's slightly sci-fi, you know, slightly Running Man-ish, but it's so, you know... What I imagine that folks in the day would want is not to give them the chance to make it through Punishment Park. They'd rather just throw them in jail or, you know, give them a lobotomy or whatever it was. But to your point, I really enjoy that he doesn't have the moderate voice in the film, that he has the two extremes and you just kind of bounce in between the two. At no point does he kind of make fun of the people that are on screen, you know, and he could easily do that. He could turn this into something where it's like, oh, can you believe how horrible these policemen are or these other people are? And he really does a good job of balancing everything out.
And I think at one point, as you were talking about, sort of even the humanity of the people who would be, I guess, the bad guys, mm-hmm. in the film, is one scene that kind of haunts me is the National Guardsman, who's like 18. And there's a scene where the folks who are running through the desert start throwing rocks at them because they've caught up to them, and they're trying to fend them off. And the 18-year-old ends up shooting one of them. And Watkins is grilling him, and he's just like, why did you do that? You know, why did you do that? Why did you shoot them? You know, what do you say to their family now? And the kid just starts losing it, and he's like crying, and another one comes to his aid and says, he's defending his country. It's like, what's the matter with you? He's defending his country. And Watkins like, I want to understand why he shot that person. Mm-hmm. They were unarmed, you know. They're Americans just like you. What are you doing, you know? And he's just like screaming at him for it. And the thing that was interesting to me, kind of what it reminds me of, is I was told a story by one of my mentors when I got into the business that I am in radio news. And he was telling me about covering the 67 riot in Detroit. And he said it was one of the scariest feelings of having to like duck behind cars and things like that as you're trying to cover this insurrection on the streets of a city, where he goes, there were kids younger than me. He's like 18-year-old kids. And I remember he told me about this, like 18-year-old kids in National Guard outfits that barely fit them. You know, they look like children carrying rifles through the streets. And he's just like, I'll never get that image out of my head. And to me, it was like watching that part of the film reminded me of my mentor telling me about that situation.
I like that switch, too, when Watkins goes from being such an impassive narrator. I mean, all of those times where he's narrating and just saying what the weather is the mm-hmm. temperature, you know, this increasing temperature in the desert. And then when he finally kind of interjects himself into the film. I mean, you never see him, but you hear that voice, that accusing voice as he goes along. And it really, it it hits home even more that he's been so impassive throughout the film. And then when he finally gets to that point where he starts to put himself into the film, just really makes such a difference.
As you get towards the end and it really starts to ramp up where he's hammering them and they're coming back at him, is there's several different things that come up. One says something like, oh, well, the only reason why you're here is so you can, you know, film this and then show this and make money.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the use of media is nothing more than a money-making tool.
Right.
And that the only reason why you want to cover bad news is because you'll get ratings to some extent. So I've heard people have said that to me in my time as a reporter. They don't want to talk to me because they're like, oh, well, you're just gonna use me. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting is it's not really sort of mentioned and brought out that way, but you kind of get the feeling that if Watkins and his crew in this scenario stopped filming, they would be the next to get beaten up by the cops or even shot.
Right.
And that by continuing to point the camera at them, continuing to, you know, shoot film, they're safe. And it almost reminds me of what we've seen with some of the Occupy movement protests, in that the people who are in those protests are using their cell phones or using cameras, whatever, and they're continuing to take photos or record video or whatever of the cops during these situations. And they found that when they do that, it makes them safe because then the cops are less apt to attack them.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. I saw a documentary a few years ago about tribes in Africa and some of the civil wars that they were having, and just the way that having the camera on some of these guys with guns and just be like, you know, oh, hey, yeah, I can go out and just like just do these completely heinous acts because they knew that they were being filmed. So you can do one or the other. You can stop beating up the protester because you know you're being shot or, you know, on film, or you can go ahead and cut their arms off. And I mean, this documentary I saw was completely horrific, but, you know, and just do these things because you know it's going to be out there, and like it's like a war trophy. So you kind of get that a little bit with the one cop who's, you know, talking about his weapon and kind of showing the, all these, you know, the intricacies of his shotgun and all this kind of stuff. You don't necessarily have that later on in the film, but it really brings to question what would these people be doing if they weren't being filmed. You know, it's that whole, like, does the world change when you turn a camera on it?
That's one of the things that I think anyone who's in media is always, you know, trying to consider, is how much does the event change as soon as you start documenting the event.
Right. All right, so we're going to take a break here, and after we come back, we're going to play an interview with Professor Joseph Gomez, author of a book on Watkins and a friend of the filmmaker.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
1972, I was teaching at a community college in upstate New York called Mohawk Valley Community College. And a friend and colleague at Utica College, Scott McDonald, whose name you might recognize, who's written a lot about non-narrative American independent underground film, we decided we wanted to sponsor something called the Utica Film Symposium. I had a friend who had seen Punishment Park and tried to track down Peter Watkins, and finally did so. And he was going to have a tour with the film, and the tour fell through, and the only two schools that were still interested were University of Toronto and Mohawk Valley Community College. Unfortunately, they were on the same weekend. And Peter did something that is so typical, and that is he decided he would go to the community college instead of the big-name university. We screened the film in the spring of 73 to a packed house of about 500 people, most of whom were incredibly hostile. And we had arranged a television interview. This was at a local TV station, like at 11:30 on a Sunday morning. And I look back now, and Peter wanted to talk about social and political issues. And Peter started talking about the media and suddenly looked at the camera and said, the best thing that could be done would be all of you watching this show to shut off your television. At which point I thought the director behind the camera was going to have a coronary. But Peter left, and I thought, I will never see him again. And quite the contrary, he wrote a letter asking if I would help him coordinate other college and university screenings of Punishment Park.
Tell me about this screening. Like, what were the reactions? I mean, how were people expressing their, let's say, distaste with the film?
Utica, New York was essentially a blue-collar city in worse shape than Detroit. The industry had left. This was a small community college, and here was an Academy Award-winning filmmaker coming, and we had already arranged and shown The War Game, so people had some idea. They just did not or were not prepared for something that struck home at that time as much as this film did. The negative response was, there were many, but the dominant one was, how dare you, a Brit, come to the U.S. and criticize our way of life? And I think they missed, a lot of people in the audience missed what I feel this film is really about, and looked at it just as a scathing attack on the U.S. and on anyone who defended the war in Vietnam.
How do you think it sort of spoke to that time and what was going on? And then now, 40 years on, what do you think it says to us today?
The person who really had a sense of both, if I can say that, is Peter himself. Because after the film was pretty scathingly attacked when it was first shown in New York, and later in London it had mixed reviews, he said, Punishment Park is about yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And I think he never saw the film as simply about what was going on in the United States at that time. When the film was seen at that time, a number of the characters in the film were echoes of actual historical people. Bobby Seale, Leroy Jones, Joan Baez, Tom Hayden, people in the before the tribunal. All had echoes of those people. So it kind of resonated with an audience. But the real problem that the audience had was, is this real or not? They kind of knew that it wasn't, but they had to be reassured. And once they were reassured, they were pissed off. They felt that somehow they had been cheated. It had to do with documentary style, what was presented in a style of documentary not being true. when I guess I last showed this in a class maybe 2 or 3 years ago, that was not the effect. The audience had become much more sophisticated about how the style of documentary could be used to present something that was not true, and the whole question of reality TV, et cetera, et cetera. People at that time really did see it as a kind of metaphorical commentary about polarization in the United States, about the war in Vietnam. I think people in the last class I showed this to saw it as a statement about the nature of polarization and about the fact that when you have such extremes as what was presented in the film, there's really no way these people are listening to each other, and there's no way that you can bridge the gap between them.
Were there other films that you can think of around this time that were doing anything similar? I mean, maybe like Kramer's Ice or something, but another like faux documentary style.
I think the three most politically important films of that period, and you mentioned a key one, and the only other film that I would mention that uses a similar device, but it's different, is Haskell Wexler's Medium Cool. What Wexler did was he was making a film about people in the media, and he was in Chicago at the 68 convention, and fiction and reality begin to mix together. Ice was an important film. The difference is both of those films had limited exposure, but they did have exposure in large cities. Watkins with Punishment Park, by and large, for, oh my God, decades, he would go around with a 16mm print of that in a suitcase and screen it. And for him, the most important thing was discussing it after the screening. He wanted people to think about the media, how we're manipulated by the media. He wanted people to be concerned about repression, whether it's a literal oppression or a kind of psychological, shall we say, repression. He really wanted to use the film as a kind of catalyst. This may be reaching, but I kind of look at this film and the way Peter used it as being similar to Orwell's 1984. If you look at 1984 and the first reviews when the novel came out, they said this was an incredibly grim, impossible, pessimistic work. And Orwell's response in part was, well, yeah, if conditions reach this particular point, then there is no way out. And so that the work itself is optimistic, shall we say, in the sense that it makes us aware of these possibilities and what you have to do to stop it now. And I think that Peter felt very much that way with Punishment Park. But it wasn't as if you wanted to pick one side over the other. I think what he really wanted was, let's talk about how we can avoid coming to this particular end point. So the film became a catalyst for discussion, in which he would never give an answer. I remember a class discussion once in which somebody said, this film is far too pessimistic. I mean, you don't give an answer. There's no resolution. It's just that it goes on. And the metaphor of the game is totally depressing. And his response became, if I were really cynical, I'd make silly comedies. I'm not giving you an answer because you have to come up with the answer. And I have enough faith in the audience for them to do that.
I don't know if you've talked to Mr. Watkins recently. What does he think about the Occupy Wall Street folks taking a look at this film and maybe gaining some sort of discussion point or some sort of understanding from the film that he did now 40 years on?
I have not had a chance to talk to him since I found out that they wanted to show the film. I have talked to his wife, and I know that he gave permission through Oliver Groom for them to do that. And I think that he, according to his wife now, had some qualms afterwards because he just doesn't want the film to be seen in the context of the film. He wants it to relate today, and he wants it, people to discuss it in a certain context.
To be honest, when I watched the film, and there's the voiceover about the McCarran Act, I wasn't familiar with that history. I actually had to go look it up. I thought it was a device that was made up by the film in order for it to work. And then I looked it up and was kind of shocked to know that this internal security detention law had been passed originally in the 1950s. With things like September 11th, Guantanamo Bay detentions, things like that, what do you think the film says today to those kind of issues?
Again, he's remained pretty much true to himself and true to his beliefs in fighting repression. And I think he was as shocked as all of us were about the bombings and 9/11. I think that he is aghast at the Guantanamo and the way in which the Patriot Act has stepped on the rights of both Americans and non-Americans. And I think, again, his statement would be, Punishment Park is about yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Can I read a quotation that may help to explain a little bit of not on this issue, but of the sense of history? This is Peter. I use the word history. Actually, I do not believe in the traditional concept of past events being locked in position by a block of text or an image on a canvas. I believe we are all history, past, present, future, all participating in a common sharing and sensing of experience which flow about us forwards and backwards, sometimes simultaneously, without limitations from time or space. I think that is a partial explanation for some of his cinematic techniques, and it's a partial explanation for his evaluation of social political patterns. Ironically, by the way, the McCarran Act was finally done away with just as the film was being released. But as Peter pointed out at the time, Nixon, when he put all those demonstrators in the stadium in Washington, didn't need the McCarran Act. And I suppose we've got the Patriot Act, but if people want to suppress rights, they'll do it with or without the Patriot Act.
The release of the film, you talked about how he was very particular in how he wanted it screened, he wanted discussion. Is that part of the reason why it took so long for it eventually to come out in some sort of home video format in the United States? Or was it simply that distributors were shying away from the film and they just didn't want to put it out because they saw it as a political hot potato?
Certainly when the film first came out, it was a political hot potato. It did win a prize when it was first shown at the Atlanta Film Festival. What happened there was it alienated both the left and the right. The left was very annoyed at what they felt was stereotyped depictions of the young radicals, and the right looked at it as simply leftist propaganda. When it was shown in New York, it was pulled after 4 days, and the company that was distributing it was Shipex, I think, if I remember correctly, which also distributed various porno films or softcore films. The money behind the film, ironically, came from Churchill Films, and I've been given to understand that the owner of Churchill Films, Joan Churchill's father, was pretty conservative. She obviously has anything but, and her career after that has indicated her views. Aside from this 16mm print, I think there was only one 35mm print. There was a budget of $66,000 and then $25,000 to blow it up to 35mm. But I think there was only one print. Since there was no distribution, nobody was much interested. And finally, a company in France expressed interest in bringing it out on DVD just a bit before Oliver Groom and Project X did. And Peter was able to get the original negative from wherever Churchill Films had it. Simply because nobody was interested in it, it hadn't a wide distribution. I think those were the major reasons after the initial political reasons for not having it screened.
You've obviously written a book and you've been studying him. You've known him almost 40 years. What is it about his work that keeps you interested and keeps you coming back to it and making him someone that you think people should know about and appreciate as an artist?
If I can go back to Orwell, and this isn't so much as an artist, although I do think he's a wonderful artist, but B.S. Pritchard called Orwell the conscience of his generation. And I think that in many ways, Peter is the conscience of our generation, yours, and I'll go back away with mine. He is someone who has an important vision in which he's trying to undercut soothing conformity. He's attacking repression. He has a political social vision, and he lives it. No, certainly, filmmaker that I know lives the frugal life that Peter Watkins does and has turned down projects that could have given him money. I mean, there's a stubbornness about him, but there's also an incredible integrity. And I think that in certain films, not all, but in certain films, he's able to create an incredible cinematic vision in which there's a profound statement presented in aesthetic terms that are never conventional.
I'm very curious to hear what Mr. Watkins is up to these days.
It's never been easy funding films. And he keeps talking about maybe one more film, but I don't think it'll ever happen. What he has done instead, he's created a website where he talks about his films, but primarily he talks about his media criticism. And this exists in France. It hasn't been translated, but most of it is on that website. And it's a collection of essays called The Media Crisis. And that's part of what he's doing now. He's making a CD-ROM of a place called a college at Brecon. This is where he went to British public school, and it's a CD-ROM which has lots of stills, lots of text, no moving images. Right now, it's really only available to people who are former students at the College of Brecon. And I keep coming back to Orwell, but in my mind, it's a CD-ROM presentation not unlike Orwell's Such for the Joys, in which he writes about his own school days as a microcosm and metaphor for society today. He lives in a small, and believe me, it is small, village in the middle of France, Felton, and he's right now doing a number of interviews with people in this village. Most of them are very old, and he's doing this in terms of trying to cover the history of the village, but also the history of France before World War II and after. He's doing projects that demand no money from outside sources, really. And they're very personal projects. But again, I think they have all kinds of historical resonance.
You said that there was another film you wanted to do. Do you happen to know what that film may be?
There have been a number of films over the years. Before he made Punishment Park, he wrote a script for the Learning Corporation of America called State of the Union. I have what may be the only extant copy of that now, and it's about 800 pages. It's impossible for Learning Corporation in 71 to even really seriously consider that. That was about the Civil War. And he did make a videotape presentation for a place called Videotape Network, which was a kind of slideshow that dealt with the Battle of Antietam. It's fascinating to look at in terms of kind of puncturing conventional views of the Civil War. But again, I have no idea whatever happened to that. I don't even think that Peter has a copy anymore. He wanted to make a film about Strindberg, which he finally did 10 years later in a very different context from what he proposed. he wanted also to make a film about Marinetti, the Italian futurist. That was funded in part by Rai in Rome, and then that was dumped. He wanted to make a biography film of the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin, and began 2 years of research on that, and that never came to fruition. At one point, he wanted to make another version or a kind of follow-up version to the War Game. The only thing that he mentioned after the Commune film, which is something he wanted to make for years, was a possible film about the Spanish Civil War. But I don't really know how serious he was about that. And at one time, oddly enough, way back after the War Game, Hollywood was interested in having him, I don't know who in Hollywood, but someone was interested in having him make a film about Native Americans. And Marlon Brando was involved in the project. But Peter never worked well with professional actors.
Yeah, I can't imagine those two working together.
Yeah.
No. No.
Welcome back to the projection booth. It was a pleasure talking to Professor Gomez. He's forgotten more about Watkins and his filmography than most people will ever know. Rob, let's go out of the park, as it were, to talk about other films that play with the same documentary conventions that Watkins played with most of his career. I know that some people cite Jim McBride's film, David Holtzman's Diary, as a major milestone in faux documentaries, but I'd like to go back further to something like Buñuel's Land Without Bread, or even the granddaddy of documentaries, Robert J. Flaherty's Nanook of the North. This whole staging of events in front of a camera, I know we talked about that a little bit earlier, but the whole staging of events versus trying to capture real life is just, it's always been fascinating to me. There are some that say that just by observing something that you're changing what you look at, you know, kind of that Schrodinger's cat kind of thing. I'm a big believer that in picking up a camera and shooting something, it changes what you're shooting, not to mention the editing of it.
Yeah, definitely something like when we talk about Flaherty's Nanook of the North, actually that lifestyle that the Inuit, the Eskimo were living at that time was completely different.
Right.
And when he put that film together, he was actually asking that family in Nanook to go back and do things that they had done maybe 50 years before. So I know in the event of things like that, he was trying to recreate something that had been already previously dead.
Just some of the shots just were so set up, and it's funny that one of the first major documentaries was playing with documentary form, even as far back as then. I mean, you know, the whole history of cinema, when you look at it, you had the fantastiques of Méliès, and then you had the actualities of the Lumière brothers, and it's just like, you know, you can go either way, but then, you know, it almost right out of the gate, you start playing with the two things and mixing them together.
And then you end up with something like putting the two together to some extent with things like Birth of a Nation, where,
right,
you know, Griffith was trying to do, quote-unquote, reenactment of things.
Right, it's like Andy Kaufman showing the actual footage of Lincoln's assassination, and you would show Birth of a Nation, and people would be like, oh my God, how did you get that film?
I've always enjoyed documentary. I've always found documentary to be fascinating. And then the idea of pseudo-documentary, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, and I think maybe the audience is probably hipper for it now, for pseudo-doc,
mm-hmm,
than it would have been maybe when Punishment Park was created in 71.
Right.
Because we've had just an onslaught of just things like Survivor.
One of my favorite pseudo-documentaries, and I love the way that they did this. There were a few films like this where you shoot an actual documentary, and then you mix in fictional elements with it. There was one by Foreman back in the day. I think this is even like pre-Black Peter kind of stuff, where he did all these auditions for, I believe it was for a musical or a movie. It's been a long time since I've seen this. And he shot all these regular people coming in and doing their audition, but then he also kind of went behind the scenes, and I'm using air quotes that you can't see in Radioland here, behind the scenes and shot an actress doing the exact same thing, plus kind of her behind-the-scenes story, following her home and doing interviews with her and all these kind of things, mixing the two worlds together. So you've got, it reminds me of Sandman. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that, where it was a documentary on these different, very extreme filmmakers, Beelzebub and all these different guys. And then the filmmaker in that case, I'm forgetting his name, but I'll have to look him up. But the guy who made that one also shot a fake part of it and mixed that in to make it look like it was real. And that was about a guy who was hunting these women and shooting all these videos that looked very much like these other videos. But then you don't really know what happened to the women that were in the videos, as if implying that he had been murdering all these girls. So it's really super creepy, especially when you mix that in with the other people and you mix it in with the Scream Queen interviews and the, you know, we go out and we shoot these gory videos and the more blood, the better kind of stuff. And here's this guy doing this, but he's doing it for real. I mean, Watkins, I think, had a little bit more control over what he was doing and saying, like, you are this kind of person, you are that kind of person. Now go. But I think that now go moment is when all the artifice drops and they just get to, you know, be those characters, as it were.
Yeah. And then I also think of something like the Wells film, like F for Fake.
Oh, God, you know, that's so good.
Where you have all these documentary ideas and Wells is taking you through a narrative, although the narrative is very disjointed, about all these fake ideas about, like, a guy who's one of the foremost paint forgers, right, you know, paintings, and the guy who wrote the Howard Hughes book and all this stuff. And then he's interspersing it with his own fakery. Mm-hmm. And the film itself, of course, is fakery. And he's trying to get you to understand that as well. So it works on so many levels.
That line of the first 40 minutes, I'm going to tell you nothing but the truth. And then after that, I lie. And then, like, what is it, 50, 60 minutes into it, he's like, oh, by the way, it's more than 40 minutes now. You know, it's like, oh, that's so good. he is just the master conjurer in that.
Yeah.
So it was J.T. Petty that did Sandman, and that one, you're going to have to see that one. I think it's finally available for a long time. It was so controversial, kind of like Punishment Park, that it wasn't available for a long time.
Well, Mike, you know, after you let me borrow the DVD, I typed Punishment Park into a couple of search engines, and a news story came up about Occupy Wall Street, of all things, and the report said that there was a group called Occupy Cinema that was planning to show Punishment Park to the protesters actually at Zuccotti Park in New York City. So we got in touch with John Dieringer, who is part of Occupy Cinema, to talk about the film and why he finds it relevant to the Occupy movement.
It's a really complex film. You know, the relationship of, like, reporters to subjects and the way the film crew gets involved. And there's discussion about filming the violence from the police against the protesters, which I think has obvious parallels to the way that cameras are being used, you know, sort of like a shield in a way against potential police brutality, which, of course, the movie is obviously it's a metaphor and it's like a much more extreme scenario than people being pepper sprayed. And there's also an interesting debate in the movie that I think is a lot more maybe relevant, you know, more relevant to Occupy Wall Street than a lot of other movies like Battle of Algiers. And I think that's one thing that really marks this movement is the sort of the nonviolence of it and the way that, you know, in a sense, it's like very much people are very much on board with sort of obeying the letter of the law. Punishment Park gets into that both in terms of discussing, you know, should we be violent protesters? Should we obey the law? And then, of course, also the idea of the rules that are set up in this game also is sort of a metaphor for that. The end of the movie, I think one of the characters says something like, if you play by the rules of the game, the people set up, even if they're stacked against you, that's the only way to win. And I don't think it's really clear if he's talking about, if he's using that as a figure of speech or if he's literally talking about the rules of the Punishment Park game. And that only kind of scratches the surface.
What's been the reaction when you showed it to them?
Screening actually ended up not happening. You know, it really did kind of feel like a police state, like lockdown type situation where all of a sudden the park was completely barricaded and it was flanked by both police officers in riot gear, kind of like Punishment Park, and also like these private security goon type people. Somehow I managed to sneak our screen in and someone else managed to sneak the projector in, which actually since then there was another time I was bringing the screen back and they told me it was could be considered a weapon and I couldn't bring it in. Although I just brought it in anyway, and we weren't able to get power was the issue that night. We have to sort of reinvent the wheel for every screening we do because the situation's just always changing with, you know, like power, police. There might be like one time we were doing a screening and like Angela Davis showed up and it was just sort of like, well, I guess we should stop her screening.
So are there plans for the screening to happen again?
I'd really like to find a special way to show it, because I do think it's a really great film. And we were all really just incredibly honored and moved by how quickly Peter and his distributor, Oliver Groom, gave us permission.
The film itself, Punishment Park, what do you think that it offers, or what does it say to people who might be in Occupy Wall Street or interested in that movement?
It's really about like debate and dialogue. It's definitely a film that, you know, when you see it in a group setting, encourages a lot of spirited discussion. Sometimes it's kind of fun just to watch, the cops in this movie are you know, really, you're really rooting against them. And even though the movement, I think, is very respectful of law enforcement in a lot of ways that maybe people wouldn't expect, maybe in sort of like a cheeky sort of way, it would be funny to show a movie in an area flanked by police, movie which frankly portrays law enforcement in a pretty awful light, which, again, like a lot of things in the movie, it's you know, a lot more nuanced than that.
What other things are you thinking about showing at Occupy Cinema? What other things do you think really kind of speak to what's happening now?
I think it's important that, you know, that the film not only has like a sort of interesting ideological backbone, but that it also is, you know, sort of truly independent. And, you know, like it would be really great to show something like They Live, like the John Carpenter movie, which I, you know, like I think a lot of us we've talked about, like we really love. But, you know, at the same time, it sort of like pains me to think about this, but it does come from that the studio system where, you know, when if we were to, like, you know, pay a licensing fee, when you follow it up the corporate chain, it's like, I think like Comcast owns They Live or Time Warner or one of those, I forget which one. So yeah, I mean, the work is all, it's all, you know, very independent. Yeah, I guess other movies that have come to mind, we did a screening with Ken Jacobs, who's been just overall like great supporter of the movement. And so he put together a program of some of his recent works, Capitalism, Slavery, Capitalism, Child Labor. Everyone was just so into it. And the work, I mean, it was perfect. Some of the stuff we'd like to show, we can't for various reasons in terms of, you know, we don't want to be like charged with obscenity or something just because, you know, there's like violence or blood or, you know, like watching Punishment Park today, I kept thinking of this movie, Emperor Tomato Ketchup by Shuji Terayama, which is portrays this world where all the kids have sort of like usurped or, you know, like killed or enslaved all the adults. And there's this tiny despot who goes by the name Emperor Tomato Ketchup, who's sort of, you know, presiding over this like fascistic state run by these, you know, children who are sort of like dressing up like, you know, military figures. And it's really sort of anarchic and like a really, you know, amusing and also extremely unsettling satire of like fascism and, I think, you know, sort of like extreme ideology in general. There's another movie that I was reminded of, Police State by Nick Zedd, which is shot in the Lower East Side. And basically Nick Zedd, I think, is just like walking down the street or something. And this just horribly like stereotyped asshole cop is just like starts giving him shit. And he gets like really angry at the cop and they're shouting at each other. And then they take him back to the police station where he's totally brutalized. Actually, both those movies are pretty extreme in different ways. Like Six Side of the Pentagon by Chris Marker, that's another one we've talked about showing a lot. There's really no shortage of great work, and also artists and distributors who have expressed their support for the movement and for Occupy Cinema specifically. Personally, and, you know, I can sort of speak to my own thoughts more than maybe all of the group. I think we sort of I guess don't really consider like where our money's going when we go to the movie theater. I mean, not to be sort of preachy about it, that idea of like voting with your wallet when you go to the movie theater. Corporate chains that have, you know, appropriated these like big box retailer type techniques to move into the suburbs and basically obliterate family owned or cinemas owned by like real people, eliminating union projectionists. People don't really bring a lot of financial accountability to the film industry. I think particularly in, you know, things like the way that I think studios really take advantage of tax credits, which Actually, probably in Detroit, you have a lot of like productions coming through. So I think Michigan has one of the most attractive tax incentives for film production companies. It's kind of a scam, you know. And I think just in general, it's like, you know, raising consciousness about the movement in general. Just sort of prodding people to take a look closer at whatever their field is.
So basically, what you're telling us is you're looking forward to that new Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, totally. What is the new Adam Sandler movie?
Jack and Jill.
What's it about?
It's Adam Sandler. Does it really matter?
Yeah, there is no plot.
I wasn't sure if he was, you know, trying to be like a mature actor now, like a
type
transformation. Or
he did that once with Paul Thomas Anderson, and it didn't work out so well. So
right. Actually, that's a pretty cool movie. Yeah, Adam Sandler. I don't know, man. Kind of thought he was dead.
I'm glad that Punishment Park still has the resonance that it did, and I think that more folks really need to check this film out. I mean, it was just kind of came out and disappeared. It's funny, the first time that I saw this film, a friend of mine from Toronto, Colin Geddes, he gave me a VHS tape of this. And it was great because this is, you know, years before it came out on DVD or anything. And that lent it even more of this, like, you know, forbidden quality to it, like it had, like, escaped from someplace. I hope that they actually do get to show it in Zuccotti Park, because I think a lot of people would get a lot of information out of it.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's something that's interesting that you have a guy like John Derringer talking about Punishment Park. You know, it's 40 years on, and for a film to still have resonance
right
that long out is amazing. And when you watch Punishment Park, it's kind of interesting, as we talked about with Professor Gomez as well, is that you can see it still, that it is a film that even if you showed it today, probably be a little hard for some people to take,
mm-hmm.
who have certain political leanings or certain things like that. It's kind of hard to watch at times, especially some of the beating and hunting down and shooting scenes. He doesn't shy away from that kind of stuff. He's really trying to make the point.
Other films that I think would really spurn other discussions, you know, some other of Watkins's work. I mean, stuff like The Gladiators or even The War Game, those kind of things. And then a film that I talked about earlier, Spook Who Sat by the Door. I think that's also a very valuable film to talk about. And again, you're talking about urban guerrilla warfare. John had mentioned Emperor Tomato Ketchup. Really don't think that's going to be that's not going to go over too well, just because of the that film is very popular amongst pedophiles, because there are a lot of underage children that are in this movie, a lot of nudity going on. But it is an interesting film. It does present a lot of interesting points, but I think they know that they wouldn't be able to show that one out on the streets anytime soon. But it was interesting, though, that I see that they have Throw Away Your Books, Rally in the Streets, which is another Terayama film, which I think is going to pack as much punch. That's it for a special edition of The Projection Booth. The show will be back next week at its usual bat time and on its usual bat channel. Be sure to come back then.